and welcome to the Physics Department of the Undergraduate Book of the Books. I'm Dr. Sarah Tonetti, and I'm a lecturer in that department where I teach undergraduate regression courses. If you're here today, it's because you want to find out what it entails, what might be involved in doing a physics degree at the LSE, and potentially what kinds of jobs you will be able to get at the end. So I'm going to talk to you a little bit about each of our degree courses, but first of all I'm going to start off by trying to inspire you to why you might be interested in statistics as a degree option. And then I'll talk you through CS and Natural Science, BS and Statistics, and Statistics of Life. But first I would like to show you a clip by Hans Rosling, who is this statistics guru, just to give you an idea of one of the reasons why you might be interested in.
Awash with data that comes pouring in from everywhere around you. On its own, this data is just noise and confusion. To make sense of data, to find the meaning in it, we need a powerful branch of science, statistics.
Believe me, there's nothing boring about statistics, especially not today when we can make the data sing.
With statistics, we can really make sense of the world. And there's more. With statistics, the data deluge, as it's being called, is leading us to an ever greater understanding of life on Earth and the universe beyond.
And thanks to the incredible power of today's computers, it may fundamentally transform the process of scientific discovery.
I kid you not, statistics is now the sexiest subject around.
Hans Rosling is not the only person who says that statistics is sexy. So in particular, Hal Varian, who is the chief economist at Google, said in his article in the New York Times that he keeps saying that the sexy job in the next 10 years will be statistician. So if you all want to go into sexy kind of employments, this is one of them. So why statistics? As the video clip indicated, in today's computer age, we collect data all the time on almost everything. Every time you access your tablet, your phone, your PC, your Mac, somewhere data is being gathered about what you're doing online. And it's not just that. There's lots of data collected on just the whole financial market, stock prices, on our own bodies, or those of animals and plants, DNA, climate. Every day you're recording temperatures, humidity, everything you can possibly imagine in the air around us, health, or, in the UK particularly NHS patients, but around the world, patients of every type, buying behavior, supermarkets, online, internet search data, what you get up to on social networks, and the list goes on and on and on and on. We now have increasingly fast computers. They're now 10,000 times faster than they were just 20 years ago, just before some of you were born. And they're getting faster and faster exponentially every year. And this makes it an ideal world for statisticians, because with all this data, statisticians are the people that take it and turn it into something that's manageable, that can be interpreted, that can extricate relationships. What is it that drives climate change? Is it human beings, or is it something else? What is it that makes some people prone to certain diseases and not others? Is it their DNA, or is it their lifestyle? This we can condense out. They can understand the trends in, well, hopefully, stock prices. So statisticians use statistical techniques to turn all this mass of information into something that we can understand, relationships that can inform decision making on every level, from what you want to have for dinner to what the government recommends in terms of spending. Okay, all of this can be extracted from data by using statistics. Example that you're probably all familiar with to a greater or lesser extent is, for example, online shopping. Look at Amazon. You go to Amazon, you enter their website, start clicking around, you buy something, you log in, and all of this information is being recorded somewhere. And somewhere in the background, there are some statistical algorithms that some statisticians come up with, and they're trying to understand what your buying patterns is, so that they can either offer you something that you might be interested in buying, or figure out what things people are buying generally, so that they can inform Amazon as to what deals to put on so that they can make more money. And when Amazon suggests you might like this because you've bought that, it's because they've seen other people that have bought similar things and they have gone on to buy that thing that they're suggesting, and they're hoping that maybe so will you. So every time that you see that you click on a suggested item to buy, you're actually making use, or the statistics are using you to make money for Amazon. Another thing that you might be familiar with are store cards. A Nectar card is an example of a store card. Right? Every time, maybe not you, but your parents go into the shopping, they have a Nectar card, they swipe their Nectar card. That is Sainsbury's, or in this case Nectar, gathering information about your shopping habits. And together with the shopping habits of all the other people who have Nectar cards, they can figure out what things, for example, people buy in pairs. Now, if people buy X product often paired with Y product, then if you have a deal on X product, then maybe you can increase the price on Y, and overall you make money, for example. This is a basic idea, but this is the principle. So even though you might get a voucher from Nectar at the end of the month or something, really, you're making more money for them than they're giving you back. Which is fine, because that's the whole way of the game. Hotel booking websites, flight booking websites, all of these use, so this is a greater or lesser degree, to try and come up with relationships between how people, you know, what people buy what, so that they can use this to then offer deals. I recently found out that there are some hotel booking websites that use the kind of browser that you access with as a way of deciding what kind of offers to what kind of deals to offer you. So for instance, if you come to the website with a Mac, they will offer you higher-end deals. If you come to it with a PC, they'll offer you lower-end deals. Because some statisticians figured out that the kind of computer that you use is predictive of the kinds of things that you will want to buy. So constantly, online, in the internet, statistical methods are being used in the background to try and increase the profits of the companies that you buy and search with. Another use of where there's lots of data is things like to do with DNA. DNA is now one of the most importantly researched fields in medical science, and you can't do this without statistics because this is just a small bit of data. Okay, this is a SNP, and it's 63 patients, so not even that many patients. You can imagine that some studies will have thousands of patients, and for each of these thousands of patients, there are, in this particular case, there are 2,308 genes sequenced. Okay? It's a tiny fraction of what we could be looking at. And I have colleagues who work in these kinds of areas who are looking at billions of data points. The yellow indicates weak expression of the gene, and the blue indicates strong expression. And expression is essentially the part of the gene that is active, that you can see, for example. Now, different types of cancers give rise to different kinds of gene expressions. Also, you can think of different kinds of your own genes make you prone to different kinds of cancer. So you can look at both aspects of it. And advanced statistical methods, because you can't sit here and do it all yourself, so the method itself is designed to learn from these kinds of data what type of gene expression is associated with which kind of cancer. Okay? And this can help diagnose cancers in future patients. For example, you know about things like breast cancer or lung cancer, but even within the cancers of different types, some of them are better, easier to deal with than others. So if you know which type it is exactly, you can tailor the treatment to that specific cancer. And this can help a lot of people. But the kinds of things you can do with DNA are vast and many. I have colleagues who work on phylogeny, which is trying to use your genetic expression, to figure out your ancestries, you know, maybe for trees or for animals, in order to see, you know, descended from this or this other thing. And then this also for bacteria, to see where do bacteria come from, for example, where do some viruses come from. So the lots of data aspect is one aspect that is very interesting in statistics, and statisticians are very good at dealing with. Another thing that I particularly enjoy about statistics is that if you do it for long enough, you learn to think critically about everything. So whenever you see a headline, and we'll see a few of them, that involves risk or likelihood, you start thinking, wait a minute, where did this data come from? What is it trying to say? Are there any other underlying causes? You never just take things at face value. And also you become very particular about things like, when you get ads on the television about some particular product being absolutely brilliant, and 70% of the people that tried it think it's absolutely great, and then you have a look at the bottom, it says how many people it was, 10 people. We know that this can't rely on this kind of evidence. You become very sensitive to these kinds of statements. So if you do a statistics degree or indeed one in natural science, you learn to understand the concepts of risk and probability, which are concepts that are quite difficult for people to understand generally. You become familiar with numbers and complex situations, and this enables you to find employment in almost any industry that you could possibly imagine. So, of course, you're here because your passion is mathematics and statistics, but maybe you have other interests, and you could think that you would like to be able to find jobs perhaps in industries that are related to your interests and not just the statistical part of it. So this particular article here from the New York Times, also the one where the quote comes from that I was saying earlier about, you know, I keep saying statistics is a sexy job for graduates in the next 10 years. It's about a woman who did a degree in anthropology, but she liked the whole maths and statistics part of the anthropology and archaeology bit, and now she works for Google doing statistics. So statistics is something that unites lots of different things, from archaeology right down to sort of search engine stuff at Google. It spans very many different disciplines. This is a headline, the one I was talking to you about earlier, and this is quite a recent headline, this is from last week. And this is the Daily Mail online, and it says, TV and computer games wreck family life. You need your child peace. So, you know, I read this and I'm like, really? No, where does this come from? And so I actually found this from a website that I'll show you in a minute. But this article from the Mail actually is based on a scientific article which states the following paragraph at the top. Across associations, the likelihood adverse outcomes of children range from a 1.2 to 2-fold increase for emotional problems, blah, 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 for each additional hour of television viewing. So, having looked at the article and the data, I came to the conclusion that these conclusions are actually wrong. They tried so many different comparisons that, purely by chance, some of the comparisons will be significant, which means that they will be statistically meaningful, and not just, you know, part of chance. If you do 100 comparisons, just by chance, 5% will be significant. And they did so many comparisons that obviously some of them weren't significant. And then they went and they picked those comparisons and ha, there you go, television viewing is bad for your kids. Or rather, it causes them to be unhappy and fat. Most likely, really, if you think about it, television viewing is a symptom of underlying, you know, family dysfunctionality, perhaps low income, I don't know, other things. It is unlikely that TV viewing in itself is the cause for your child's emotional problems. Another thing that I picked up from particularly the article in the Daily Mail, but also some other articles. You can't maybe see it, but it says here, maybe doubled. This is a classic thing you get in adverts as well, where, you know, they say you could have up to 100% off or something, what they would say, up to 50% off or maybe. When you say things like maybe or up to, that doesn't mean anything. Because maybe could mean nothing at all, so maybe doubled, but it may not be. And up to 100% could mean 1%. Still within the range, they're not lying. So you see, when you start engaging in statistics on a daily basis, like I do, you start becoming very sensitive to this kind of thing. You know, you believe what, you know, what is said to you. And although I'm thinking on the tabloids here, the truth, this can also be said of other kinds of newspapers. If you're interested in this kind of important stuff, the website understandinguncertainty.org is quite interesting. But this is, you know, this isn't going to necessarily help you get a better grade in exams. It's just going to get more information. Another similar headline, this goes from a few years back, is about how there was a study published in the medical literature saying that bacon is bad for you. It increases the chances of colorectal cancer in men by 20% if you eat, you know, bacon. And the Sun has quite a funny headline, you know, save our bacon, but he baffles, which is classic alliteration here. But is bacon actually that bad for you? Now, there's two ways to represent this information. The first is the one that I just said now, the kind of headline-grabbing one. An extra 50 grams of bacon consumed on a daily basis increases the risk of cancer by 21%. This is a large percentage. Or, you can think about it like this. Turns out that over the course of a lifetime, 5 out of 100 men typically get colorectal cancer. If all of them, all 8, 1 or 2 rashes of bacon every day for life, 6. would get colorectal cancer. Hardly as horrifying as the previous statistic. And yet they mean the same thing. So it teaches you to look under the hood of all these statements and think about what it means before you jump to conclusions. This is another example where it's nice to be a statistician because you think about thinking about the bigger picture. Now this is national debt as a percentage of national income. And this is the kind of thing that you hear, you know, the parties in the UK anyway, you know, quibble about. Labour saying, oh, because of you, our national, because of your Tory government, our national debt is awful, terrible, doom and gloom, we can save the world. So this is data from 1992 to the present day. This is data from 1962 to the present day. So we, that slide I just showed you before, is this corner over here. So you can see that much, but far worse situations have happened in the past. Now specifically, if you look at some of these peaks, okay, now, this peak here is kind of the aftermath of the Napoleonic Wars. Maybe you don't know anything about that. I didn't know much about it either before. Basically, there was a war between Britain and France. That's probably the usual thing as the neighbors. And Britain came out on top of. And as a consequence, it kind of opened the world of fair trade. Because before it was, you know, that Britain was kind of an empire and they had kind of all these monopolies. But now it became fair trade. And actually Britain did very well from the fair trade. And this corresponds to a very, very prosperous moment for the UK economy. And if you think about it, kind of, you can see why. National debt means that the country are taking on a lot of debt. Which means potentially people are interested in investing in that country. Why would you invest in something that's going to default on your debt? You're not. So in this case, it's an indication of a good time for Britain's economy, not a bad time. Then, you know, the national debt decreases, and there's a very, very happy, prosperous time here, the important times. And then World War I hits, and then you get this peak again. It goes up there. Understandably, war takes money. You need to pay for it somehow. National debt goes up. Then this kind of ridge over here is the Great Depression, and things weren't very good there. So then you get World War II, and after World War II there's a recovery. And again, national debt increases, but it's actually quite a good time for recovery after the war. It's not such a terrible time as you might think from just looking at the plots. And then in the 1970s, things did end up getting a bit worse, and so on and so forth. Then there's the 90s and current times. So it's just an indication that just because something looks bad, if you think about it, or you look at it sort of perspective, it isn't quite as bad as you might have thought it is. And as a statistician, you can look at something like this, and you can piece it together and try and understand why it's happening. Another thing that might get you excited, this is the kind of different course that you want to do, certainly, that gets me excited, is what's called Simpson's Paradox. There's a number of this kind of paradox in statistics. And it basically teaches you to always try and understand whether there are some other underlying forces going on that you haven't taken into account. So in 1973, this was the Berkeley University, which is a university in the United States, their graduate admission data. And this is just a bar chart, 44% men and 33% women that applied, not accepted. 35% women that applied, but accepted. And the question was, is this difference in admissions rate statistically significant, and therefore are Berkeley, you know, sex discriminating here? And as it turns out, if you do the maths, I don't bother you with that too much, you get a p-value that is very, very small. What does a small p-value mean? It indicates that it is extremely, extremely, extremely unlikely that such a large difference in admissions rate arose by chance alone. The implication being that it's kind of either intentional or somehow careless that may have. And as a consequence, Berkeley got sued for lack of sex discrimination. Was this the right thing to do? It turns out, if you look at the good, it isn't actually right. So this is the number of people that applied by sex in each of the six major departments. And this is the admission rates per department. So broken down by department. So if you look at it broken down by department, you'll see that in most cases, there's a slight bias towards women. But the overall data seemed to show that the opposite was going on. And that was just because, if you put all the data together, a significantly higher percentage of male applicants are accepted than women, is that women were applying to more competitive departments than the males were. And as a consequence, it looked like the opposite was happening from what was actually happening. Okay? Because you need to have a look and see how this relates to that. and then to the overall data, and not just look at the overall data. And this particular example of citizens' paradoxes is an example of what's called confounding. Another similar kind of issue of confounding in a different context is called the low birth weight paradox. Now, I'll show you what the plots look like quickly. So this here on the y-axis is neonatal mortality, so death of infants around birth, which is before birth, and this is the birth weight. So at the dashed line is the women, the babies of women who smoked during pregnancy, and the bold line is women who didn't smoke during pregnancy. So if you look at just the low birth weight babies, so say the ones on this side here, it would look like smoking decreases infant mortality. If you just look at that plot. Actually, so keep that way. Also, down here is birth weight by percentage mortality. So here you can see that on the other hand, so the smoke exposed here and the unexposed there. Now, what is actually happening is that smoking causes babies to have a lower birth weight. It's a fact. But other causes of babies having a low birth weight are far more serious than smoking. And they're usually indicative of an underlying problem with the baby. So being with low birth weight is a symptom of a worse problem than just smoking. Okay, so why is this why it looks like smoking is good for you? It's because, good for infant mortality. Because if you are low birth weight, the likelihood is that it's because of something much worse than smoking. So again, as a statistician, you look at this data and you think, okay, this obviously doesn't make sense. What is the underlying thing that's happening there? So you're always encouraged to look under the hood of things and never just take the face value of things. So that's kind of the statistics-y part. The other kinds of things that we do in the department, particularly the actuarial science degree, is about risk analysis. So actuarial science is basically a discipline that applies maths and stats methods, and they're pretty like advanced and hardcore at that, to understand risks in the insurance and finance industries, specifically, mainly in fact. So anything from things like natural disasters, earthquakes, tsunamis, or man-made disasters, oil spills, or things like the Icelandic ash cloud, and weather-related things like floods in the UK this winter, for example. They all mean that insurance companies either have to pay out or have to come up with some scheme so that they don't have to pay out too much. And obviously to do this, insurance companies have to assess both the likelihood of a disaster occurring, so how likely is it going to be that this winter we're going to have the same kinds of levels of floods as this, coming winter we're going to have the same levels of floods as the one that just passed. And also, how much are people going to think? So, is the damage going to be of a similar kind, or is it going to be less or more? This kind of thing. In order to do this, of course, you need to understand the history of these disasters, and also come up with formulae to relate the extent of the disaster damage to how much you're going to pay out. So, lots of maths and stats required. Just more specifically, the floods in recent years in the UK in particular have led to houses in flood risk areas having higher insurance premiums. And this is obviously because the insurance companies don't want to pay out too much and not make enough money themselves. In fact, this is from January this year, the Association for British Insurers say that insurance claims reached more than 420,000, sorry, million. Over the last winter, although that's probably not the end of it yet. And obviously, it is not in the best interest of insurers to have to make lots of payouts. In fact, and this is a fun fact, risk analysis and insurance both have their roots in gambling. The kinds of mathematics that you use are similar very similar to the mathematics that bookies use. Because effectively, insurance companies are like gamblers, right? They want to charge premiums in such a way that the odds are stacked against the person who's taking out the insurance in favor of the insurer, because otherwise the insurance company wouldn't make any money. Right? They don't want to be paying you out more in claims than they would be getting themselves. Obviously, it's okay for individual people to maybe get paid more than they pay in, but not overall on average. So a lot of it is very much like gambling. It's about all of our abilities. And here in this pie chart, you can see this is from the membership of the Institute of Faculty of Actuaries, that's what this stands for here. This is their membership. And over 50% of those people go into pensions and insurance, which is about the same kind of very simple kind of maths going on, hedging your bets so that you can insure the wins. And there's a large portion of that, like, some other things, but there's people that then go into investment or education or health and care. But the vast majority then go into those are actually practicing actuaries and insurance companies. So the kinds of things that you might hope and get excited if you're interested in this kind of thing is another paradox, this time the St. Petersburg paradox. And this is a casino game. So you can imagine that a casino offers a game of chance for a single player, in which a fair coin is tossed at each stage of the game. You start off with a pot of £1, and the pot is doubled every time a head appears. The first time a tail appears, the game ends and the player wins whatever's in the pot. So if it takes a k times for the first tail to appear, then the player wins 2 to the k minus 1 pounds. So how many pounds would you pay in order to be able to play this game? Okay. Classic economic activity theory says that you should consider the expected payout of the game. And the most simple expected payout of the game goes like this. With probability of half, you win £1. With probability of a quarter, you win 2. With probability of 8, you win 4. And if you add up all these products, it just turns out to be an infinite series of additions of a half, which, in the limit, becomes infinite. So really, you could make, in theory, could make an infinite amount of money by playing this game. So you should be willing to pay any amount of money to be able to play this game. Obviously, you wouldn't, and it doesn't work that way. You have to come up with a different way to find the utility in such a way that you don't get an infinite expected outcome, because you would never win an infinite amount in real life. Now, apparently, most people wouldn't pay more than £25. I doubt I would play. I wouldn't even pay that much. So hopefully this kind of thing is something that you're interested in or that you find interesting. That would be a good indication that you might be interested in this kind of degree. It's all about that. Okay, so enough of the sort of hand-wavy fun stuff, some practical facts. The kind of industries that require statisticians are financial and actuarial industries, and more than 50% of our graduates go on to work in the city in some way, shape, or form, or in insurance companies. Pharmaceutics, so clinical trials, genetics, lots of statisticians for genetics. Lots of sort of internet side things, Facebook, Google, Microsoft, they all need statisticians. They make research, everybody in the department, pretty much. Teaching is also an option, obviously. And then there's a smattering of statisticians in almost every other industry that you can imagine. Supermarkets, marketing, things like Network Rail, the NHS, the environmental services, so DEFRA, which is the Department of Food and Something Administration. I have a colleague, someone who did their PhD in things, what's there. I also have a friend of mine who works in the insurance company in weather-related insurance. So they advise insurance companies regarding weather. So she's a weather scientist, statistician. Specifically, the destinations of the three different degree courses. So BMS graduates, 50% of them go into banking and finance. So in the city, either here in London or often back home or where they're from. Accountancy, 20%, consultancy, 20%, and then 10% go on to do master's degrees. And then typically with the master's degree, they kind of cycle back into the same kind of industries. Or go on to do academic research. That's the finance. It's similar, but the more skewed towards banking and finance, as the degree course kind of hyper might indicate. 60 to back to finance, 20 to consultancy, and 20 go on to do master's. And the actuarial sciences, 40% go into actuarial sciences, so they will go and they will finish all their exams and they will actually train as an actuary. The remaining 40% might not go into actuarial training, but they will go into accounting, banking, and other kinds of finance. And 20% will go into postgraduate studies. The Faculty and Institute of Actuaries, which is kind of one of the main bodies, is the main body of of actuarial science in this country. If you complete the actuarial science degree, and you don't veer off from the kind of core options, then you are exempt from the core technical stage examination for CT1 and CT3 to CT8. There's CT2 and CT9. Those are the ones that are missing. So you're exempt from a large portion of the actuarial training core technical exams. And we also have a accreditation scheme whereby if you score highly enough overall in the whole of the degree, even in some of the exemption examinations for those eight courses, some courses you haven't scored enough, if overall you have, then you still qualify for the exemptions. And it's a very close link. People in the department are working with people in the institute, in faculty of actuaries. And if you want more information, you can go to this site, just Google Institute Faculty of Actuaries, and then that will be the first page that you'll find. And to end off, I will show you another very fun bit, in my opinion, about world health and wealth by this guy again.
Visualization is right at the heart of my own work. I teach global health. And I know having the data is not enough. I have to show it in ways people both enjoy and understand. Now, I'm going to try something I've never done before. Animating the data in real space with a bit of technical assistance from the crew. So, here we go. First, an axis for health. Life expectancy from 25 years to 75 years. And down here, an axis for wealth. Income per person. $400,000, $4,000, and $40,000. So down here is poor and sick. And up here is rich and healthy. Now, I'm going to show you the world 200 years ago in 1810. Here come all the countries. Europe brown, Asia red, Middle East green, Africa south of Sahara blue, and the Americas yellow. And the size of the country bubble show the size of the population. In 1810, it was pretty crowded down there, wasn't it? All countries were sick and poor. Life expectancy were below 40 in all countries. And only the UK and the Netherlands were slightly better off. Not much. And now, I start the world. Industrial Revolution makes countries in Europe and elsewhere move away from the rest. But the colonized countries in Asia and Africa, they are stuck down there. And eventually, the Western countries get healthier and healthier. And now, we slow down to show the impact of the First World War and the Spanish flu epidemic. What a catastrophe! And now I speed up through the 1920s and the 1930s. And in spite of the Great Depression, Western countries forge on towards greater wealth and health. Japan and some others try to follow, but most countries stay down here. Now, after the tragedies of the Second World War, we stop a bit to look at the world in 1948. 1948 was a great year. The war was over, Sweden topped the medal table at the Winter Olympics, and I was born. But the differences between the countries of the world was wider than ever. The United States was in the front. Japan was catching up. Brazil was way behind. Iran was getting a little richer from oil, but still had short lives. And the Asian giants, China, India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and Indonesia, they were still poor and sick down here. But look what is about to happen. Here we go again. In my lifetime, former colonies gained independence, and then finally they started to get healthier and healthier and healthier. And in the 1970s, then countries in Asia and Latin America started to catch up with the Western countries. They became the emerging economies. Some in Africa follows. Some Africans were stuck in civil war and others hit by HIV. And now we can see the world today in the most up-to-date statistics. Most people today live in the middle, but there are huge differences at the same time between the best of countries and the worst of countries. And there are also huge inequalities within countries. These bubbles show country averages, but I can split them. Take China, I can split it into provinces. There goes Shanghai. It has the same wealth and health as Italy today. And there, is the borderline province of Guizhou. It is like Pakistan. And if I split it further, the rural parts are like Ghana in Africa. And yet, despite the enormous disparities today, we have seen 200 years of remarkable progress. That huge historical gap between the West and the rest is now closing. We have become an entirely new converging world. And I see a clear trend into the future. With aid, trade, green technology and peace, it's fully possible that everyone can make it to the healthy, wealthy corner.
Well, what you have seen in the last few minutes is a story of 200 countries shown over 200 years of history. It involves a total of 120,000 numbers.
Well, I think so. And that's all. Do you have any questions for me? Oh, no, you have. Any questions? About anything for the data, no, the application or the requirements?
Could you say that this is more maths?
The more maths that you can do, the better. Now, if we are aware that some schools don't offer third maths, and that has not much to do with that situation, so therefore, just do maths. But if you have third maths, you should do it. The more maths, the better. Yeah.